The sponsor of this week's episode of the Mobile Dev Memo podcast is Clarisites. Tired of waiting for updates to slow dashboards that don't tell you the complete story? Tired of manually aggregating data on spreadsheets to understand your campaign performance? What if you could access all the data you need in one place without dependencies on SQL, spreadsheets, or valuable data team resourcing? That's why performance marketers at Uber, HelloFresh, Delivery Hero, and many others trust Clarisites to run marketing reporting, automating all manual work and helping them focus on insights that drive performance. What used to take weeks now takes minutes with Clarisites. Go to clarisites.com/demo to try it out for free. You'll see why thousands of performance marketers trust Clarisites every day.
The problem is that the distinction needs to be drawn between the competence of the economists and the correctness of their analysis.
Welcome to the Mobile Dev Memo podcast. As always, I am your host, Eric Sufer. With me today is Rishabh Jain. Rishabh, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. How about you?
Good. I always get anxiety when I pronounce your name because you instructed me on how to pronounce it once, and I feel like it's not intuitive for me. I feel like I just flubbed that, and I'm wondering if we should retake.
No, actually, you pronounced it exactly correctly. It's literally Rishabh Jain. Yeah. So you got it perfect. Yeah.
Okay, because the emphasis is what throws me off, because it's the emphasis on the sh, not the Rishabh. It's not Rishabh, which is how I would naturally pronounce it. It's Rishabh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the 30 minutes of practice that I undertook before this recording paid off then.
Oh, God, that's funny.
So you are recently back from Shop Talk. How was that?
It was electric, man. It was electric. No, I'm not joking. Okay, so last year, I would say it was like flaccid, for lack of a better word. You know, because it was like one of those situations where it was like everybody was feeling bad. Everybody was like, oh my God, my CAC is super high. Because it's a commerce conference, right? And so everybody's like, oh my God, my CAC is super high. The economy is really bad. Right. My investors are down my throat. They're asking me to like shift into retail. How the heck am I going to do that? I need to lay off half of my staff. That was the atmosphere. This time there was like probably like at least 50% more people. There was money sloshing around everywhere, especially people interested in like retail media and reinvesting in growing their online channels. And so it was, I feel like it was a 180 last year to this year. It was such a different vibe.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. And that is a nice setup for this podcast recording, because I think we last spoke roughly a year ago, and that was during the doldrums you described. But it's funny because, you know, I did the Taking Inventory podcast last Friday, and the hosts were like, are you going to Shop Talk? And I was like, no, I can't go. I've got, you know, my wife has to be out of town. I'm at home with both kids. And the, you know, GDC, the biggest gaming conference was also this week during Shop Talk. And everyone was asking me, are you going to be there? You know, here's an invite to the party. They're like, no, I can't go. You know, I've got to be home with both kids. And so everyone I know had an exciting week full of parties and stimulating conversations, and I was at home with both kids, including a newborn. So my week was not electric, but I'm glad to hear yours was. So congratulations are in order. Before we start the conversation, you just raised a Series A.
Yeah, man, I'm trying to get you as much capital leverage and make your investment as large as possible.
I appreciate all the hard work you're doing on my behalf.
Yeah, I have two jobs for existing investors: drive capital leverage and increase the value of the investment, right? So doing both of those things.
And appear on podcasting.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
well, congratulations to you. And I appreciate all the hard work. As you know, I came in the pre-seed, so I was an early believer in the vision, and you know, the vision has delivered. And to your point, there is more enthusiasm around e-com, around retail, and around digital advertising now than there was 1 year ago. But there are some questions. There are some questions on the horizon. There's some uncertainty. And so why don't we kick off there? What are the implications for retail and e-com of the deprecation of third-party cookies in Chrome? So for those who aren't kind of keeping up with this, Google recently instantiated the deprecation of third-party cookies in Chrome with like a 1% rollout, right? So we have kind of limited data. My sense is a lot of the people that have presented on their observations, they're getting kind of skewed data. It's like very specific skewed data sets, skewed samples, because a lot of it's, you know, publishers or the agencies that work with specific types of publishers. We don't, Google's published some reporting, but it's intermittent and it's a little bit flawed in some cases. Like the last reporting, they ran a simulation where the targeting didn't change. So it was the measurement with the Privacy Sandbox was done where the targeting on the inventory hadn't changed. And so it's like, well, you can't really interpret that because the targeting is going to change. So we're still kind of like in the sort of theoretical phase is my point. So
yeah.
I'll ask you, what do you think the implications are for retail and e-com from the deprecation of third-party cookies in Chrome?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, I always like to like go back and just very quickly remind ourselves of the other tracking mechanisms that have already been deprecated. So Safari with ITP in 2017, then Apple with iOS with ATT. And so it's my way of doing this is by looking at what has already happened and then seeing what was the impact of that. So ITP, I think, is the closest analogy. And Safari traffic relative to Chrome traffic, when you bid on it, is 30 cents on the dollar. So what does that mean? It means that if you're bidding on like an open web exchange, the value of that impression is 30 cents on the dollar because the targeting is so much worse. Now, the bigger kerfuffle with Google is that they're trying these other, like the Topics API and things like that in their privacy sandbox to actually, they claim to help ameliorate the ability to target. I am personally pretty skeptical. You know Paul Bannister pretty well. It seems like he's pretty skeptical too, at least from what I can tell on X, as to whether or not that's actually going to get close to what a cookie-based targeting mechanism is going to give you. And so I think generally speaking, if you're an e-com merchant, you're already heavily biased towards like Meta and search ads. And I think that if anything, what this does is it makes it even harder to buy ads on like open ad networks. It'll continue to like drive more people to go into search-based. And, you know, I think we're going to talk more about retail media, but I consider retail media search-based advertising, right? So whether that's Google or retail media search-based advertising or Facebook, honestly, because Facebook is one of the few ad platforms that has done a very good job with their server-side tracking. Even TikTok is not as good. And the reason for this, which is like somewhat nuanced, is that Facebook, you actually log into from your browser on your computer, whereas TikTok, you do not. And this is like one of those like micro nuances of like different ad platforms that people don't fully appreciate. So I actually log in with my Chrome browser to like Facebook. And Facebook, therefore, has the best cross-browser ID graph on the open web because you log into it all over the place. So they see and understand your cross-device footprint. Whereas TikTok, you're only ever on your phone. What does that mean? It means you're basically only ever going to the website through the in-app browser. And so their ability to like reconcile you after the fact is actually very hard if you're going back to it from Chrome, and will definitely get impossibly hard if you're going back to the brand's website through Chrome later. And so I think like the net of this is that more people will spend more dollars on Meta and search-based ads. And my hunch is that the efficacy is going to drop by at least 70% on open ads.
That's okay, 70%. So yeah, so Paul, who's been on the podcast, he had written kind of like the first thread about this, and he said they were seeing about 30%. But again, it's just 1%, right? It's 1% rollout. So I feel like you can't really trust that data. There's going to be skew too with the publisher groups. But okay, so a couple important ideas there that we should highlight. The first is that if you're only ever accessing the web-based content in the in-app browser, well, that ITP applies if you're on iPhone, right? So ITP, so that's the issue that I think a lot of people ignore here. I wrote a piece about this a while back, like 2 weeks ago, called like the open web is whistling past the graveyard. I think people are not appreciating the sheer magnitude of the impact that deprecation is going to have. But one of my points was like, look, this is not too big to let fail. We can just let this fail, right? Because it's probably 20% of the digital ecosystem, right? Cookies haven't existed on the iPhone, on the iOS at all since 2020. So 2020's ITP was rolled out in 2017. 2020 was when they fully deprecated third party. And then they came back in and they also imposed some limitations on first party, which are pretty severe. So all of that web-based browsing or web-based measurement shifted into the walled gardens. That's been their modus operandi since then. So before, I mean, even before ATT, I mean, ATT was a big seismic shock and probably more important than Safari because it was apps. And again, because app-based is where a lot of the engagement happens. So the writing was on the wall here. And so the walled gardens, they shifted all their activities to first-party cookies, which are impossible to do with the open web. You can't get a first-party cookie from a DSP through some random publisher. I think that one thing that's not appreciated here is the difference in how in the sort of the dynamics of the open web, where the DSP is an intermediary, the SSP is an intermediary, and you've got the buyers and sellers, right? And any given publisher is just one tiny little sliver of overall addressability, right? Whereas Facebook is all addressability for all people. Facebook is the single publisher that has total addressability for all people on this planet that could be addressed on a smartphone, right? It's 3 billion plus daily active people. You can't get bigger than that.
Totally. Not only can you not get bigger than that, but you're saying, okay, I just want to double click into what you're saying because I think it's very hard for most people to follow. So like Facebook, not only does it have the widest reach, but all of those people are logged in all of the time on all of their devices versus a open web publisher where the reason DSPs and SSPs exist is because you have to aggregate all of that traffic. And so you're not logged into those environments all of the time. And that's why it is like literally like the physics is not possible to do it through a first party cookie. You have to do it through a third party cookie in order to drive sufficient aggregation to be able to bid on those properties. But as soon as you put a third party there and Chrome says you cannot use third party cookies, you're dead on arrival. This is the thing that I guess like it's so hard to explain this nuance because it's just not true for TikTok, right? So many people are like, oh, Facebook and TikTok. And it's like, no, like you are not logged into TikTok
right. All
of the time, all over the place. But Facebook, you are literally logged in all of the time, all over the place.
Right.
And that is like a massive difference.
Right. And the reason that there's no possibility of some random open web publisher getting a first party cookie. It's so like Facebook can get the first party cookie. Why? Because all advertisers interface directly with Facebook. And so Facebook has in setting up your Facebook account, here is the first party cookie pixel code. You must copy and paste. Click next when you've done that. And they validate it. And until you've done that, you may not set up your advertiser account. How is a publisher going to get that from an advertiser when they don't know who the advertiser is? The advertiser is going through an intermediary. And why would an advertiser is not going to do that for 100,000 listicle websites? There's just no possible way. It's impossible.
Yeah, exactly. That's the aggregation problem, right? It's like, that's why it has to go through there. Yeah. Anyways, it's such an interesting issue because it is literally like the physics of the open web will not let it work. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's not like an opinion here. This is like, yeah, I think this is the one thing I'm like sufficiently passionate about that I want to make sure people understand who are listening. This is like not an opinion that Eric and I are sharing. This is just like,
it's not up for debate. It's
literally the physics. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think, you know, what was misunderstood going into the 1% deprecation. So I got a lot of inbound about this end of last year was, hey, how much is this going to hurt Facebook? Is this a short opportunity? And I was like, what are you talking about? No, Facebook's got first party cookies. Like I thought that was well understood. And I was like, so it's talking to people who were invested in this or basically public markets investors that their misapprehension here was that this was going to hurt Facebook in some sort of disproportionate way. And it just took this education. That's why I wrote this original piece about who's hurt by third-party cookie deprecation. And that a lot of people were like messaged me privately. So, oh, thanks. That was very informative because there's this total lack of understanding about that ecosystem. And people thought Facebook did measurement that was, no, they haven't done that really for a very long time. I mean, a lot of the engagement shifted into apps anyway. Secondly, they did first-party cookies, which they can get away with because they have the leverage, right? You know, now we talked about last time, like a lot of the measurement companies had used the domain masking techniques to get their first party cookies integrated, which, you know, Apple cracked down on has like a year ago, but they were doing that for a while. the DNS masking. But no one else can really legitimately get a first party cookie. And so Facebook has that. But anyway, they've got Kappy. And anyway, they've got, you know, they've got AEM. And anyway, they've got, you know, call it the server to server integrations. And no publisher can get a first party cookie. No single publisher can get a Kappy integration. That is working programmatically. Now, if they're doing direct deals, it's different. But that was another point that I made in the Open Web article was that, well, the companies that stand the best chance of doing that are becoming walled gardens anyway. Like, so if you can get a, you know, first party cookie, if you can get, like, why not just go direct? Why not just build your own ad tech? And that's what's happening. And so like the truly open web, the sort of like nameless anonymous websites that just want to monetize programmatically, they can't ever do that. And they are really facing this dramatic reduction in CPM because there's really no alternative.
The one thing I think that's worth mentioning before I forget is that this Kappy style integration is going to become necessary for ESPs and SMS providers too. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, is like something that I suspect most people don't fully internalize. The way that like Klaviyo or Attentive or any of like your email SMS marketing campaigns are doing measurement against, I mean, look, there's no like algorithmic bidding. And so the impact on right. targeting is not as severe, but the way that you're doing the measurement on the back end is you send an email to somebody, they click on that email. This is all desktop, by the way. So email, unlike your apps, are like heavily desktop based. Therefore, yeah. Chrome has the higher impact. So you click on this thing and then it sends the UTM param. And right now Klaviyo has a third party cookie on the site. And so what is going to have to happen is they're going to have to build a system similar to Facebook where it has a click ID that can write into the first party cookie and then through a Kappy-like integration, send that data back into Klaviyo server side so that way you understand your email and SMS campaigns just like you are understanding your actual like, you know, publisher acquisition campaigns, like, you know, Facebook being a publisher. That is one thing that I think, especially for e-commerce, is a specific one that I think, again, like a lot of people are not fully appreciating the technical lift that is going to be expected from these merchants, because they're going to have to build, like they're going to have to do all of these different like server to server integrations to all of their different platforms,
right?
Whether it's an advertising platform or a quote unquote retention platform. And that is like something that I don't think too many people are thinking about.
Yeah. And again, it's like, who has the leverage to demand that integration? It's like Snap's even having a problem with it. Pinterest is having a problem with it, right? I mean, now is some like middleman, you know, SMS measurement tool going to be able to do that? Like, no, you can't do that with every, and because the problem also becomes, you have to send all your data. Like, you don't know which like that's the point. You don't know which conversions were driven by that provider. So you have to send all your data. And that becomes then a liability.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be like your five biggest platforms
right.
that you're driving your revenue with. And that's why I think it like, in fact, it aggregates revenue to like Facebook, Klaviyo, yeah. Attentive, like all the big Google, like those are the places where it's going to aggregate revenue because those are the places where you're going to bother to send the signal back. Mm-hmm. And so it's just going to get better. And then right. you're going to spend more money there. Yeah. It's, this is like a... Look, I'm not a monopoly like lawyer or anything like that, but when I saw the Apple lawsuit against the phone, I'm just like, guys, like they destroyed the ad market. They did not destroy the mobile phone market. Like there's tons of mobile phones.
Don't get me started. I wrote a thing about that last night because it just, so first of all, they picked, and I mean, this is, we're totally off topic here, but they picked what I believe to be the most trifling grievances that you could imagine. So like just as examples of the monopoly abuse, right? So like they picked no super apps. iPhone owners don't want super apps. They want native apps that perform really well. They said that the market was performance smartphones. And then they're talking about things that only exist on low-end smartphones as being a suppression of choice. No one wants the super apps. That's the whole point. Because if I have a performance iPhone, I want a native app that runs really well with like high fidelity. I don't want a super app with HTML5 grep. Like those are always clunky. Anybody that's developed an HTML5 app will tell you they don't work. You always end up going native. Like you can't do that. And then the other one, the smartphone compatibility. Who is complaining that their Samsung smartwatch doesn't work as well on their iPhone? If you're paying $1,500 for an iPhone, you're paying the $400 for the Apple Watch. Like you can't say our market is performance smartphones. Therefore, the consumers that are relevant here are the people buying performance smartphones, but there's probably some tiny little sliver of them that would prefer a low-cost Samsung smartwatch. That doesn't make any sense. I think they painted themselves into a corner with that market definition, because that's the only way it works to claim that they have any sort of monopoly power, right? Because it only works when you define the market as the performance smartphones, totally. The high-end smartphones. But then they're trying to say that consumers are being abused because they can't go and pair their low-end Samsung smartwatch with their $1,500 iPhone. What are you talking about?
but I mean, yes, I'll say one last thing and then we can like swim back into e-com and third-party cookies. But I literally use Jabra earphones with my iPhone and they were great. So, you know,
there you go. I mean, I'm no fan of Apple, but if you're going to go after them, go after the substance. The substance isn't the phone. No one has a problem with the phone. Everyone wants it to just work. I don't want it to sit there and have to configure things forever. I want to plug in. I want all of the connectivity to be seamless. And that's what you get. The problem is on the services side.
Exactly.
Epic tried that. They lost. And so the DOJ went after the consumer-facing stuff, but the consumers are happy with this. If you're going into the premium smartphone market, you want stuff to just work. That's why you're paying the premium. That's what you're paying the premium for. I take it out of the box, and it seamlessly works with everything. Not me sitting there trying to configure every possible low-cost ancillary piece of hardware. That's not the point. That's not the point of buying the premium smartphone.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
All right. Well, okay. Anyway, we're off reservation. Okay. So we talked about direct implications. So direct implications is probably hurts the open web. You'll never believe what these 10 celebrities look like now. Websites, they're going to see their CPM drop substantially. What are the underappreciated knock-on or indirect consequences? So you talked about, you think this drives more revenue to the walled gardens. What else? Is there anything else, or is that just basically it?
I mean, the biggest thing that I think is the retail media thing. I mean, I think you and I are like in vehement agreement on this, but I think like, the other big underappreciated knock-on effect is that all of a sudden, slowly but surely, especially e-com merchants are going to creep their way into having to spend on more and more retail media networks. And it's going to be like, first, it'll be Amazon, which most people don't even think of as a retail media network. They just think like, oh, it's Amazon, but it is the best retail media network, right? So it'll start with Amazon, then it'll be Walmart, then it'll be Uber. By the way, Uber's ad network, it's getting very good. I'm like so impressed with the different surfaces that they are making available for advertising. Like it is, I think it's going to be like I'm not one to give stock advice, but I think it's going to be like a hidden gem that emerges.
Well, it's a billion run right now. I don't know how hidden it is.
Oh no, I just don't think people invest into Uber because of the ad network. I'm saying.
Yeah, I get it. I hear you.
And so I think like these things are going to become more and more, and all of a sudden the advertiser is going to sit there managing like 10 to 15 retail media networks. I think that does like two things knock on from that. One is that there's going to be agencies who are going to have to support the advertisers in spending across multiple retail media networks, because of course they don't integrate with each other. And then the second set of things that is going to happen is some software provider eventually will try to like help rationalize all of this. That way you can like look at the measurement from all of your different retail media networks to understand the incrementality across from them. I think this retail media network thing is like super underappreciated by the average person, and especially by the average brand, because it's just going to like creep up on them.
Yeah. And I think there's a couple of things. I agree. I think, and you know, Walmart buying Vizio, I mean, what that was in preparation for
brilliant.
That, right? It was very smart. It was a very shrewd maneuver. So a couple things. So my sense is it's going to be hard to centralize the measurement for these. I think they're all going to want you to work with their data clean room.
Of course.
And that becomes problematic from a budget distribution standpoint for the advertiser, right? Because the longer that tail gets, and you know, the more sort of like clean rooms you're having to deal with. Again, you've got the data diffusion problem. You're sending all your data, all of them. Second, the way that probabilistic measurement works is it's always going to preference just like the biggest channels, right? And so it's just the way that works. I mean, if you don't have the direct line of sight to the conversions, it's just the statistical model is going to preference the biggest channels. And so you're going to probably want to ultimately concentrate budget in the ones where you've got the most scale. And so like my sense is a lot of these long tail retail media networks are going to have a hard time getting you to integrate with their clean room. Cause it's like, well, come on, I can't be doing this to every single, you know, fly by night thing. And, you know, I'm spending 5% of my budget on you. But then on the measurement side, just cause with those kind of measurement models, you always want to try to get as much uniformity as you can. And my sense is like a lot of people will like, everything is an ad network and, you know, you see this mass proliferation of retail media networks. But my sense is like, you get the agencies trying to expend the budget that way, but you're going to get a lot of double counting if you're operating on 20 of these. And so my sense is, like, you probably end up having, like, there's clusters of contextually relevant retail media decks for certain advertisers, and they probably focus there, but Meta is never going away, right? And YouTube's never going away. And so you're going to have to think carefully about where you allocate your budget just from a measurement and, you know, sort of data control standpoint.
Totally. Okay, interesting. I actually take the other side on this with respect to whether or not a software provider is actually going to be able to measure across all of them. And I'll tell you the main reason why. I think that eventually the retail media networks who have trouble claiming more budget and some shrewd BD person put together will create enough incentive for people to allow for measurement across for them. So that way spend happens on these retail media networks and it doesn't all just aggregate to Google, Facebook, and Amazon. And I think the reason I think this is possible is we have seen partnerships form that 3 years ago, never in my wildest dream would I have thought that is possible. So, like, I would have never thought it's possible for Amazon to integrate directly into Facebook and send, like, first party signal back and forth because you're directly logged into Amazon on your Facebook account. Like, I swear to you, if you had asked me in 2021, like, hey, Rishabh, what are the chances that Facebook allows you to, or like Facebook creates a partnership with Amazon where you log into Amazon directly? I'm like, there's no way.
Yeah, right.
There's just no way that those two companies cooperate in that way. And so the incentives that the, like, essentially, like, demolition of the open open web advertising has caused is so high that I'm on the other side. I think it is possible that there will be technology that helps you reconcile it and therefore allows you to actually spend across multiple retail media networks. That's just my view.
Well, I mean, I hope so. I mean, I think certainly the agencies would prefer that because that would increase spend, right? Look, I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying it's difficult, right?
So are, like, these, like, ID networks, like LiveRamp ID and like Trade Desk ID, like, you know, these are also, like, impossibly difficult BD, like, things that are gaining, at least, like, people are opting into them. I'm not saying whether or not it's going to work, but
yeah,
like, there are extremely difficult BD operations that are in motion because this demolition is so severe. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I think what you could do is, what you need to do is, you'd probably need to have, so I don't know if this is what you're talking about, but you'd need to have, like, a trusted execution environment that is the receiver of, so it's like the singular contact for the advertiser, that they send all their data to just this one point of contact. That point of contact then distributes it out and they probably noise it up. They use, you know, differential privacy. They send it out to all of the various retail media networks that are being, or they receive data from the retail media networks and then they combine it there, right? So you probably need something like that to make that work, which is, I'm not saying that's certainly feasible, but you know, I think it's just going to be like, you're gonna have to limit the number of integrations. You'd have to have probably one provider that is able to sort of make its methodology transparent enough so that people believe this is privacy safe. And so, like, that could be like the standard bearer for this. And then, you know, maybe they just win and take the market. And then all those independent clean rooms, they are receiving some form of the data, but it's data that's been adjusted in some way that makes it more private, or it's just the retail media network sending their data to this intermediary and then matching it up, which maybe that could happen. But I think there's probably a way to do it. It probably needs to be centralized kind of in a very considerable way is my point, which again, it's, like, not impossible to think about given the magnitude of this change that's happening.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that is the exact same argument for the alternative identifiers, right? Like, that is precisely the argument. It's like, I mean, the Trade Desk surrendered theirs to the IAB.
Right.
So I don't know what it's called anymore, but I think it's called Universal ID, right?
Yeah, UID 2.0.
UID 2.0, yeah. And then the LiveRamp ID. And so, like, those IDs are basically the same argument, right? Like, actually, it should just be, like, a single one that everybody aggregates to, because that's the only way you get enough scale. The only complexity there is, like, it's very, very hard to expect consumers to log in all over the internet. Like, that is a hard, yeah, that's a hard ask to make of consumers. And so, like, the efficacy of it is very TBD, in my opinion. I'm curious what you think about it, but I think it is very hard to see how that becomes, like, a good replacement for the cookie. I think it does a little bit by way of, like, trying to, like, fill in some amount of data so that way you can start to model off of that. But there is no way you can use that as like a replacement to the cookie. And yeah, it is a very hard BD problem.
See, I think the problem is a BD problem because you need the publishers to integrate this, but you also need the users to opt in. And like we've seen, just opt-in rates are generally low, right? I mean, I think across with whenever they're implemented, I mean, that's why Facebook is fighting tooth and nail to avoid going full on consent in the EU, right? That's why they did the pay or okay model, because you're just not going to get consent. It's really difficult. So my sense is like, because, and then the thing is like, you need the same email. It's got to be the same email across publishers, right? You've got hide my email. So if you do it on iPhone, you know, you might get some random string. My sense is like they are engaging in like a false hope campaign with publishers. I just don't know how feasible that is. You're going to get people to log into every website they go to. For what? You'd have to explain why. It's for the purposes of ads targeting. And that just doesn't work. That argument just doesn't land with consumers. Like, oh, no thanks. But maybe. I mean, I think maybe if you just get this visible degradation of the web and people understand that it's because of these privacy changes, maybe they'll be like, okay, it's just what I have to do. And maybe you could sort of drag consumer behavior along with you. I guess I'm more optimistic about these sort of centralized TEE than I am of like widespread consumer opt-in, like across the open web. And because again, it's like the addressability maps to the number of websites I'm going to log into. Am I going to log into one of these websites where there's a full page takeover of the ad every time I check it out? And I remember, oh yeah, that website, I can't even read it. Or some recipe website, or, you know, like some listicle. I just don't know. It seems like a big hurdle.
Yeah. My biggest fear is like the ad load on these sites is going to have to go up so dramatically to make the finances work. Because like if your degradation in your performance is some number between 30 and 70%, then that's like the equivalent of how much you need to increase the ad load in order to make the same money. When asked, people care about privacy. But I think like if you were to not ask the question, then I don't actually think people think a whole lot about it or care a whole lot about it. And more importantly, I think that they would care a lot in action about the fact that their ad load is doubling or tripling. Because yeah, then your actual interaction with the internet is like worse. So,
well, you know, why didn't Safari capture more market share after ITP, right? Okay, like maybe consumers didn't know about it, but then, well, they knew about ATT. They definitely knew about ATT. Did iPhone capture much more market share? So the pricing differential, but like, it's like, okay, fine. But like you look at any sort of, I mean, there are focus groups on this stuff. And you just look at, well, okay, are people opting into pay in the UK or in the EU? No, that's what's aggravating the privacy apparatus there. It's like, well, no, because the price is too high. Okay, they lowered the price. Still no. It's just like people just can't accept this. I mean, it's like there's a small group of people that are energized by this ideology that isn't informed by any sort of measurable harm, right? It's just, well, I think that's really bad. It must be really bad. I think that. I feel uneasy about that. I can't quite put my finger on it, but something's wrong with that. And like, there's, okay, well, fine, quantify it. Prove it to me. Show me in any of these cases that consumer behavior's changed. No, you can't.
Totally.
And then there's always like, you know, it's like, okay, well, if enough of these stack up, you might just be on the wrong side of the argument.
Yeah, totally. But the problem is it's like so non-falsifiable.
Right.
So that's why it's so frustrating. But I guess, yeah, I guess like this is the unfortunate, I mean, like you and I are on the same side of this. So we're just going to be riling each other up.
just spiking each other's blood pressure till the end of time.
It's just silly. It's just silly. Yeah. I do think though that like, again, I think it is causing big companies to make moves that they otherwise would not have made, right? Like this Amazon Facebook partnership. Right. I think like originally it was the Shopify Facebook partnership. Yep. Where ShopPay is starting to permeate everywhere. And this I think is like very clever. I think it's very clever. So I'll just set it up a little bit. So like companies where the consumer actually does the transaction are embedding directly into the companies where the consumer is seeing content. And in doing so, they are effectively like logging in first party to the transaction point. Mm-hmm. Inside of the quote unquote publisher, where the publisher in this case is Facebook, right? So that could be like with a ShopPay embedding. So that's like, okay, you know, I'm telling you exactly who I am. And so you can close the loop inside of Facebook's ecosystem. That's true for Shopify. That's true for Amazon now with their partnership. And so I think that these partnerships, again, I think you would have never seen them had it not been for this like massive change. But I think that this is like, I mean, this is very clever on behalf of the big tech companies that are not Apple to actually, I think, eventually give the consumer a reasonable pathway, and it will never be 100%, right? It'll be like 20%, 10% of transactions happen in this way, but it'll be enough that the companies that can actually afford to do this type of integration will have enough signal that they'll be able to show relevant ads to the right people inside of their ecosystem. So again, all it does is aggregate to the benefit to the biggest players. But I do think it is demonstrative that companies are willing to make changes in how they operate from a BD perspective, given the impact that inability to track will have to their ability to perform on behalf of their advertisers. And that's like to me, the most interesting aspect here. And so to me, it's a signal that like more and more of these will happen as long as the economics actually work to make it happen.
And they do, right? They demonstrably do, right? So the canonical example of this idea that I had is the Amazon integration with Facebook and Snap. We don't know too much about
it. Yeah.
But I think the Facebook one we know more about because it just got the right press. I think the Snap one is probably very similar. So Amazon has a relationship with Pinterest, but it's fundamentally different because there's no cross-login. It's just they're just pushing demand into the Pinterest stack. But with Snap and Facebook, I call this a walled compound idea, right? So the walled compound, it's not a walled garden. It's a couple walled gardens with a big wall around them, and they're all sharing some data, not all of it, some data. Right. So with the Facebook, Amazon, I wrote about this a while back, and I think let's not just dissect it completely because I want to move on. But Amazon, when there is mutual login, the accounts are connected. Amazon sends the ad. And that's why I agree with you. If you told me 2021, hey, they're going to partner up and Amazon's going to send the ad to Facebook, I said, no way. Facebook's never going to cede control of the feed to a third party. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, no way. That's the only thing Zuck cares about. You want to know, everybody who I talk to at Facebook, sorry to interrupt, everybody who I talk to at Facebook, what is the only thing that matters is the content what the user wants to see. And that is the way they make decisions for the UGC and for the ads. But it is a single question. Is this content that the user wants to see? And right. You're surrendering the single most important question
right.
to somebody else.
To a third party.
Yeah, no way.
Now, why would you do that? Because you don't have access to the data anymore. Amazon does. So they both are missing a piece that the other has. And so Facebook's got the inventory, the social inventory that Amazon doesn't have, the social display inventory. Amazon's got the purchase history. Amazon takes the purchase history, crafts the ad, decides which ad to show to this particular user because there's mutual login, there's account linking. They send that over with an expected value. So now Facebook said, look, I really would love to curate the feed here. I don't want to give that control to somebody else, but what else am I going to do, right? If I want this extra demand that's going to boost my CPMs, I'm going to take it. They're sending me an expected value. I trust Amazon to probably do that well. They've got the data. They're not sending me the data. I'd love to just have the data, but they're not going to send that to me. They can't. So I'm going to take their ad. I'm going to take the output of their algorithm that tells me what the expected value is. I'm going to plug that into the auction. If they win, then great, the ad gets shown, user clicks, they make the purchase in the app. I don't get the conversion, my understanding, I don't get the conversion signal from, even though the transaction happened within the app, because it still happens on the Amazon site, but transaction happened and Amazon can ping that back over on Cappy. So I get Cappy data, I don't get full unfettered access to the conversion. So I don't know user level conversions, but I get Cappy data, which is good enough because I've got the Cappy engine, right? Similar with Snap. Now, who's Amazon going to do that with? Not that many companies. They wanted to do it with TikTok. TikTok say no. So who else are they going to do that with? Well, they've got Facebook, Snap. Who else? That's probably it, right? So if you're in the compound, you're golden because you still have access to that data indirectly. You still benefit from that data, I should say. But you don't have direct access to it. If you're out of the compound, you're out in the cold.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, it is really hard. I mean, I don't even know how Amazon would do it with anybody else because nobody else has enough like strength of data or right. candidly strength of engineering team right. to actually receive the data from Amazon to effectively serve the right ad to the right person, right? Like let's just like illustratively, okay, say like, hey, Amazon decides they're going to do this with the New York Times. Not possible. Yeah. I mean, it's just literally not possible. Like, is the New York Times team going to know how to like interpret that data? No way. I mean, there's just no way, right? Like, right. So even if you like tried really hard to like make it happen, it's actually like organizationally impossible to make it happen. And that's like the big kerfuffle with this situation. It creates such a big advantage for the larger companies because they're the only ones who can actually even do it, which is like unbelievable to me.
Right. It reminds me of that George Carlin quote. It's a big club and you're not in it. Right. These are the biggest guys. They don't want to work with you, small fry. Amazon doesn't want New York Times' inventory. That's not, they've got that. They've got a DSP. They don't need open web inventory. They want social inventory. So who else has it? TikTok has it. Well, they're out. And anyway, I think they're partnering to take on TikTok. Snap's got it. Okay, great. Who else? No one else has it at that scale that Amazon cares about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The thing that I do worry about, though, is I feel like you don't buy the things on Amazon that you discover on Facebook. That is the one thing I worry about with this partnership.
Yeah.
It is the types of products people buy on Amazon are very different than the types of products that people buy through social discovery.
Right.
And like the only time in the past where the types of products that people bought on Amazon were the types of things that they would buy socially was like wish.com.
Yeah.
Right. It's like that's like the last time this happened. And like essentially what ends up happening when you do that is you just end up with like a spiral to the lowest cost good,
right,
being the thing that ends up winning the auction. Because like actually when you're doing discovery-based shopping for utility items, the only thing that you buy is the lowest cost item. Or at least, again, like in the past, that was what it was, right? Like now, who knows? That's the biggest thing that I'm like, is this actually going to like accrue incrementality to any advertisers? Like who is the advertiser on Amazon who's going to accrue incrementality by advertising to the Facebook feed? Let's just say I sell a product on Amazon, right? So like I'm trying to come up with a good example. Anchor, like the charging cables.
Yeah, right.
Right? Like amazing for search-based advertising because it's like it's a utility good and like you see it on Amazon and you're like, great, I'm going to buy this for sure. The economics when you have to then advertise on the social network because like you're competing now with everybody else, right? Because it's like a single feed auction. And so the economics of paying Facebook for the space on top of the Amazon cut that they will take for delivering the product, I don't know if the economics would work for a company like Anchor. And I'm struggling to see how it would work. And so that's like my biggest problem with this whole situation is like, I think it's very smart. And I think that like, in theory, like it is like the right partnership, but I think the types of shopping people do and the types of products that get sold and the economics of those products, that is my one sort of like big caveat to this whole thing. It's like, I can't tell. I can't tell if it'll actually get used for that reason.
Okay, I want to kind of shift gears a little bit because you talked about Shop Pay, and I want to unpack that a little bit because I feel like it's flying under the radar a little bit as like an important mechanism for all of this. And there's kind of two pieces why. One is there's a couple pieces why. First of all, it makes the transaction much more seamless, right? Which is increased conversion.
Totally. Yeah.
The other thing though is Shop Cash, right? So Shop Cash is you've got this cash back program, this sort of discounts thing that exists within the Shop Pay app, right? And so you can get the retailers to offer up their products with a Shop Cash rebate kind of thing that my understanding is Shopify eats. And so you're buying the inventory, Shop is eating the discount or the rebate, but the rebate gets deposited in your Shop Cash account. So then you can use it to go buy more Shop stuff with Shop Pay. So this feels like a pretty genius, you know, strategy.
Oh,
here.
Yeah.
Did you talk about that?
Yeah. I think that, by the way, there was also an announcement that Shopify made that was signaling toward a similar ad network product to the one that you just described with Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
So in their Shop Audiences announcement, they like hinted toward, I mean, they haven't like said anything directly, just to be clear, but they hinted towards moving toward actually being able to like buy inventory both on the Shop app and off.
Mm.
And the only way that you would buy inventory off and the only other company that Facebook would want to look, Facebook obviously is going to want to hedge against this Amazon partnership. So Facebook is going to ask, who else could I do this with?
Right.
And the only company that they could do this with is Shopify, right? And this is actually great because Shopify merchants are actually literally exactly the people who would want to spend money on Facebook. And the reason this Shop Cash rebate thing is so smart is because the reason a merchant would buy inventory through Shopify, through the Shop app, is because the consumer is getting a deal that Shopify is willing to subsidize in order to drive better traffic. So let's just say because if I'm a merchant, I have two choices. Either I advertise directly on Facebook, or let's just say this new Shopify thing, right? The reason I do it on the new Shopify thing is because my CAC goes down because Shopify is eating a little bit of this rebate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still do the acquisition and I get better signal because Shopify now has the ability to integrate directly with Facebook. And so you get enough CAC reduction that you're willing to do it through the Shop app, and Shop app will still give you all the first party data, unlike Amazon. And so I think that I hope I didn't go in too many twists and turns for people listening, but basically I think it is absolutely brilliant. I think it's absolutely brilliant. You use it as a way to drive lower CAC because it'll drive more consumers. Eventually, they will have a similar integration to the one Amazon has.
Mm-hmm.
And then advertisers will have an incentive to use their advertising dollars to drive more traffic to the Shop app.
Right.
And so this is I think this is absolutely brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Shop, it will have more first party data because they're using the app. And then so it's like this data feedback loop that's, it'll compound with value.
Exactly.
All right. I want to ask one question. So how big of a role does credit play in e-com and retail marketing, and how much has that changed, or how has that kind of financing landscape changed with the interest rates rising, with, the impact of ATT and the impact of sort of signal degradation? How has that sector weathered this? Because my sense is it kind of hasn't, and a lot of these companies have been damaged pretty severely, but I would like to hear your thoughts.
We're talking about the Clearco, Wayflyer, these kinds of companies, right? So I think, Clearco famously went belly up. And I think the other companies are struggling a lot right now because there were two big things that they were basically sending loans against, right? The first was for advertising and the second one was for inventory. And one of those has basically reduced by 80%, which is the advertising side, because people are way less willing to send credit unless you have a strong ROAS. But the number of companies that have a strong ROAS is way lower now after the ATT change, right? Because basically the way that these credit lines work is that they get paid back first on every order after you give them the credit line, right? So roughly the way this works is I give you a $50,000 loan, you use that to go advertise. Now with every order that you bring in, I get paid back first, some very large fraction of that revenue that is coming in. And so that imposes a certain ROAS on your advertising efforts, because otherwise you just wouldn't be able to pay me back. And so the amount of lending that's happening has gone down very dramatically on that dimension. On the inventory side, it is still happening and some merchants are still doing it. But yeah, the affordability is way lower. The biggest reason these companies are struggling is it would be a fine business, but when interest rates go up and they have previously raised money at a $7 billion valuation or whatever it was, they're never going to be able to grow into that valuation because now the demand for that product, for a high interest rate loan product,
right,
is way lower. Yeah. So, it is a very tough situation for those companies, especially.
Right. Except if the margin hurdle goes up, then your spend goes down. And so you need to borrow less. And it's kind of a vicious cycle, right? Yeah, that always felt like a difficult business model to scale. I mean, first, not only because it was totally dependent on ZIRP, right? I mean, that's a ZIRP era phenomenon if there ever was one, e-com credit, right?
Oh, totally, totally. Yeah. I mean, what was funny about it was actually the hardest problem for those companies was competition.
Yeah.
That was the insane thing. There were so many companies handing out low interest rate loans that the hardest part for them was just actually competing for the merchant's business. And so they were even more aggressive with they were handing out these loans. I mean, it was ridiculous. Yeah.
Have you seen Stripe's doing it now? They're giving loans against your sort of trailing whatever day income. And I don't think they're tied to anything. I don't like they're just sort of open-ended. You can get it's like a credit line based on your historical revenue.
Wow. Okay. I feel like for a company like Stripe, I just, you know, at some point, I wonder if their incentive to do things like that is just to show that their footprint is like,
right,
everything.
Yeah.
Right. Like I think that like the story they need to tell is just like, we do everything in finance. And I, you know, like I cannot tell because like their payments business must be what, like 80% of their revenue.
Yeah.
And so like everything else has just got to be the ability to tell the story in preparation of going public. I cannot imagine that like that many people would want to take a loan from Stripe. I mean, what do I know? But it's hard to imagine.
Yeah. Well, that's a risky kind of naked loan against historical revenue that, you know, might change. I guess if you think it's going to keep going up. But Richard, this is great. How can people learn more about Fermat? How can people learn more about what you're doing? Where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn. It's just Rishabh M. Jain on both. And please check out Fermat. We are here to help e-com merchants navigate these turbulent times at fermatcommerce.com.
What was the deal with the meme that went like semi-viral on D2C Twitter or whatever? Like there was someone wearing, it wasn't you, it was somebody else wearing your sweater. What was that about?
That was my actually he's Austin based. It was my CMO. He just like, he often makes this face of like wonderment or like shock. And actually somebody else on the marketing team was just like, hey, Rishabh, let's try to like, just like send this meme to a bunch of people and see like if it gets used. And it was pretty good. I mean,
it was pretty successful.
I thought it played. So
it did. It's hard to will a meme into existence. I mean, it was short lived, right? It was 2 days.
Yeah.
It had reach. It had legs. It had reach. Okay, Richard, thank you very much. I appreciate your time today, and appreciate your insight as always.
Likewise, man.